At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Football on Off the Ball
with Sky. Watch Premier League, Women's Super League, Scottish Premiership, and much more live on Sky Sports.
And you're welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5 o'clock. Remember, football and Off the Brawl is brought to you by Sky. All the football you love in one place across Sky Sports, BT Sport and Premier Sport. Our next guest, one of the greatest goalkeepers to ever play football. 5 Premier League titles, 3 FA Cups, a League Cup, a Champions League with Manchester United, a Portuguese title, a Danish title, a European Championship with Denmark. Peter Schmeichel, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
This is the book, and it's called One, and it's your autobiography, which is out now. Tell us why you decided to get involved in this book.
It started about 6-7 years ago. I went through some life changes. I left my ex-wife, was planning on moving back to England, and there's a lot of things I wanted to change in my life. And then out of the blue, I met Laura, which I'm married, happily married to now, and it kind of just completely took my life in a different direction, and it was kind of the first time in my life where things really, really changed. And I started to look back at, or started to think about who that person was, you know, what came to think about how could I, when I was so young, 8-9 years of age, how could I say and be so specific about wanting to play for Denmark, wanting to play for Manchester United, wanted to win the FA Cup at Wembley with Manchester United, and then go out there and achieve that. So I was in this process of, you know, changing direction, and all this came up. So Jonathan Northcroft, who has written this book with me, was absolutely fantastic the way he's done that. I met up with him, asked him if he would write the book, but not for publishing, just for me, just so I could see the book before and decide, was it a book that I would put out there? And, you know, he agreed to do that, and there were certain things I had to do, take my father to Poland, see, you know, go through all of his background, his old upbringing, see the places. And and unfortunately, he was not well enough at any point to take that trip with me, and he passed away, and then I kind of put the whole idea about this book on the back burner, and then COVID came, the lockdown, and I found myself having absolutely nothing to do, waking up in the morning thinking, what's going to happen today? Everything was shut, you know. I just sat down in the house, and I spoke to Jonathan and said, you know, maybe this is the time. So we spent lockdown doing this. And it was brilliant to have that, and it's been a brilliant journey for me as well to do something which I've never ever really done before. Look back and try to find answers, and you know, just have a really good look at myself.
When I started reading it, Peter, I learned things I didn't know. That it starts the book with a detail of your grandparents in Poland, both perished in World War II.
Yeah. Well, my father was born in Poland by Polish parents. He's born in 1933, and as we all know, that Germany invaded Poland in 1939. So he was 6. His father was enlisted, and his barracks, which was in Gdansk, it was called Danzig back then, got hit by I don't know if the first ever bomb, but it was on the first day, and he got very, very badly injured, and kind of disappeared. He was in hospital, and the next day they were going to go and see him, and everyone's gone. Patients, doctors, nurses, nobody there. So they never really found out precisely what happened, but he was so badly hurt, so it was a given that he'd passed away. And then my grandmother, so my father's mother, she started to work with the resistance. And when Poland was divided into, or Europe was divided into the, and East and West, Poland was on the East, but controlled by the Russians. And they rounded up everybody they deemed to be an enemy of Russia or the state, or could be a problem. And in there was all the people who had worked for the resistance. So they literally knocked on the door, took her away in front of the four kids. So this would have been in 1945. And they never found out. Well, they did, but for many, many years, more than 50 years, never found out what happened to her. So not the best childhood, and of course, a very, very traumatic experience. It's something that also followed my father's life and his being and his behaviors, and which is also something that I'm touching on in the book.
Absolutely. Your mother was a nurse and he was a piano player, and they eventually settled in Copenhagen. And what's interesting, Peter, and is different to today, is that when you were starting your football career as a young professional, you had a lot of odd jobs, you had a lot of different jobs to keep yourself going, and you're quite self-reliant.
Yes, but it was a very, very different time. So if you think, I'm now 57, so that would have been, nearly 40 years ago. And we hardly had any paid football. We did have professional sport, but it was very sort of semi-professional. So you still, even though you got paid a little bit to play your sport, you still had to have a job in order to make ends meet. I did all kinds of jobs, which I'm so happy with today, because I know all of this looking back. So that part of my life where I had to do jobs like, I say normal people, it's a wrong word to say normal people, because we're all normal, but what people are doing from whatever age until they retire, I've done those jobs. I know what it's like. And it also made me realize very, very early on that once I became a professional football player, how privileged I was to be in that job. And I always tried to treat that job with my fullest attention and respect.
Was there a mindset change with you, Peter? Because I'm reading in the book that you were quite nervous at times. You're playing for Brøndby and playing Porto in the European Cup, versus when you went then, contrasting that when you arrived at Man United in the early 1990s, where you were quite dominating, you were quite, I don't know if the word is right, but arrogant, if that's the right word.
I use that word about myself in the book.
So yeah. What happened to your mindset that changed that?
Well, I was never nervous playing for Brøndby. I never got to that. But the club that I left, I was semi-professional for another Copenhagen club called Hvidovre. Our home games, just to give an example, was Sunday night, 7 o'clock. I left work like 3-4 o'clock on a Friday, and all I could think about was this game. So that would be nearly 2 days away, and I was so nervous, really, really nervous, and it was eating me up. All the way up until the point where I started my warm-up. Then it disappeared, and I was all right in the matches. But the build-up was just, when I left and joined Brøndby, my first game I left and joined Brøndby on January the 1st, 1987. So we played calendar years back then, so that's why it was that date. My first game would be what is now the Champions League, but the quarterfinal in the old Champions Cup. That was, but the first game was an away game at Porto, against FC Porto. And, so many new things for me there. It, just simple fact that the bus had a police escort. And the way that we were driving with this police escort, just throwing the cars out to the side and, speeding down the middle of the road. And I was so scared. I mean, I really, really didn't want the bus to crash. But there was a voice inside of me, because I was nervous about the game, saying, please crash, please crash, so we don't have to play this game. I was so nervous. I got to the stadium. I didn't go up and see the pitch with my teammates. I got myself changed, and on the way up to the warm-up, which you, from the dressing room, you had to sort of go on the knees, underneath the pitch. There was a tunnel. It would have been about maybe 40 yards long. And halfway there, I stopped, and I'm saying to myself, Why are you nervous? This is what you've been dreaming about every night since you were a small child. The big games with loads of people in seats watching you, massive attention, you're the highest, you know, level of European football. So why are you nervous? Why are you not enjoying this? And something inside of me made me forget about nerves. Just cleared it completely out. It never, ever came back. I was never nervous before a game again. Never nervous in games. It was the first game with so many people in the seats and at that level, and I enjoyed, even though we lost that game 1-0 and drew the second 1-1 in Copenhagen. We competed with the eventual winners of the Champions Cup or whatever it was called back then. There was no reason for me not to enjoy that, and I've done that ever since.
Survival chances out of 10. Presumably it's 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10.
Minimal.
Zero.
When you just leave, it's only going to go down or not, rather than a marking system of 1 to 10. You're just confused, just muddy in the water.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts, and download the OTB Sports app.
It was an incredible journey at Manchester United, which was a club Alex Ferguson brought you to. If you could just sum it up in one attribute that he had, what was his best attribute? Just one, Peter, if you can just distill it into one thing.
It's one of those things I really don't like doing, you know, talking in headlines, because that's what it's going to be. A lot of people are talking about Sir Alex in headlines, you know, hairdryer is one of them.
Is that not the accurate portrayal then?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. People who knows him would never use that as the first word when they're talking about him. He's a fantastic person. Really is a fantastic person. He's a big person. He's someone who knows the way that he wants to go, but he's never closed the shot to other ideas. He is big enough to have other big personalities in there. You know, we think about Cantona, Roy, Brian Robson. People who have another idea about life as to, you know, maybe the guy next to you, or think in a different way. But what they can do on the pitch, because they are like that, is very, very valuable if it's managed correctly by someone who can handle that. And there's been a lot of managers in the world that could not handle those kind of characters.
Could he handle being challenged?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yes. Absolutely. But this is it. I know there's an example in the book. I know where you're going with this. And you know, there's always a wrong time for the wrong thing. And that was it. That's the example in there. But yes, of course. And sometimes he was looking for it. He was looking for that being challenged, because when people challenged him or the way we played, or what something said, or something, you know, after a game, he then had it confirmed that that person cared. And that was the most important thing for him, that people cared about what they're doing on the pitch, that they knew they were playing for Manchester United, and you have to give everything that you have, every little ounce of whatever energy you have, had to be challenged into those 90 minutes. And therefore, for him, it was so, so important. That you cared about what you were doing.
How did you communicate with your defenders? Were you very much in their face? They weren't looking at you because they could hear you. Like Dennis Irwin, for example. How did you communicate with Dennis? Such a model pro, somebody you respected so much, as the book will say. How did you stamp your authority on the whole situation at Man United when you arrived there?
Well, it wasn't like I felt I needed to stamp my authority, but I came from an environment where, in many ways, I was a pioneer. With the team and the club that I left, we'd introduced full-time professional football. The Brøndby had the year before I arrived. The coach started at the same time as me. He was also a guy. He was a carpenter, so he had a job the year before. You know, 9 to 5 or whatever it was, and then he was a coach at the highest level. So everyone was kind of sort of finding their way on how to do the next bit, and you know, he would be thinking about how can I, you know, how much can I train them, you know, what's right, what's the correct amount, how much can they take on board, and all these kind of things. Everything was new for him. Everything was new for us players. How do we live our lives? What do we? How do we sleep? How do we eat? All that. We didn't know anything, so we kind of finding our ways. And in there, you build up systems, you build up routines that carry you through and helps you progress. And one of the things that I had was I trained every day with the team. I never ever there was never a training session where the team were without me. I was always there. And then all my goalkeeping training was done separately. Maybe in different times where the team wasn't even there, but it was done separately. And it was only done to in the correct amount, if you know what I'm saying. It wasn't every day. It didn't have to be every day. And sort of that kind of mentality, of course, I brought that into my next job, which was Manchester United. So, for instance, the first day in training, I was used to pre-season being very, very hard, a lot of running. Not a lot of running, a lot of running. I mean, seriously, you know, we didn't see a football for maybe 3 weeks. Just running, weights, running, and building up like that. And Brian Kidd said, okay, we're going to start slow and easy. We'll start with the boxers. And I'm like, okay, fantastic. I was in great form because I was... That was the beginning of the Man United seasons, but I was kind of halfway through a Danish season, so I've already done the pre-season and all that. So my form was fantastic, and I didn't need so much physical work, but I'd expected it. Boxers, brilliant. So and he said, oh, and Peter, you can go with Jim. So that was Jim Leyden and Gary Walsh. You can go over there and do half volleys. And I'm looking at him, no, I'm not. I'm in the boxes, and they're all like all the players. No, no, you're not. Boxes, goalkeepers, playing feet, you know, all that. And I insisted. I said, yeah, I'm in the boxes. And eventually I just went there in the old group and just stood there. And eventually they just started to play. And it was important to me not to stamp my authority, but the way they didn't know me very well. They didn't know how I played. They didn't know what my skill set was. And in all fairness, there's been a lot of sort of uncertainty about the goalkeepers at the club for a period of time. So it wasn't like they were used to having someone who thought he was good enough to be in there. Or maybe that was the wrong way of putting it. But someone like me with you know, the amount of confidence I brought into it and maybe also my behaviour. So it's important for me to prove to them straight up that I could also use my feet, because I wanted my team, my defenders, to be a long way from the goal. The further I could get them away from the goal, the less chances they would create against me, the less I would have to save and be a goalkeeper. And I always, this is something that was ingrained into me by my goalkeeping coach, Jan Henriksen, that is the best way of goalkeeping, is to prevent anything from happening. So you push them up and then you develop your skills to deal with, so be a sweeper behind them, deal with anything that comes through. So it was important for me to sort of prove to them that I could deal with stuff that happened outside the 18-yard box. So that was kind of, I mean, I'm explaining all this now. It's not like all that was going through my mind and...
You've had time to reflect, yeah.
It's on reflection, of course. That is, but it was my mentality.
Obviously, in 92, you won with Denmark the European Championship. In the following year, United won the Premier League, their first league title in 26 years. Then Roy Keane arrived. We're obsessed with him here, Peter, yeah, as I'm sure you know. I'm just interested. We all see Roy Keane as a player sideways. You saw him in front of you for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
What did you see that we didn't see? In terms of his ability, in terms of his play,
yeah, he was probably in terms of that position the most dependable player I've ever played with. It is a such an important position, that because it is what binds defending. So the players that are defending with the players that are attacking, so you kind of have to be both, and you're kind of the glue. So not only do you have to be very creative when we're in possession and taking part and finding opportunities and finding players who can you know create the next bit, which is probably the chance. You also have to be that guy who spots all the gaps, reads the game, so intercepts a ball there before this happens and all that. And I don't think I've seen anybody better than that. The engine that he had, his authority in midfield to the opposition team. A lot of opposition players were scared of him, which is a great advantage when you play in that position. And also, he attracted so much attention on the pitch for other players to find the gaps. You know, Paul Scholes, it was a great partnership they had. So Paul Scholes developing into a centre midfield player was quite a surprise, because Paul Scholes, as a kid, was a striker. And you look, when we looked at that team, so everybody know them as a class of 92, you look at Paul Scholes and you see somebody extremely skillful, but also not so big. I won't call him small, just call him not so big. And you see that, you know, if he's got to make the next step, so close the gap from the reserves into the first team, he's probably going to be struggling a little bit being a striker. And then you think, but we don't play in a system where we have like a number 10, for instance. So kind of looking at Scholes and thinking, maybe he's not going to make it, because what's the opportunity for him? But then he becomes a midfield player, and he can be a midfield player because he plays next to Roy. Roy covers so much other stuff. And then, of course, he develops. So that partnership was incredible to play behind. And also, I mean, if we got to stay Irish, you know, Dennis Irvine, it's what a player and what a person he is. But what a player. I actually put that in the book sometimes, you know, where you sit with Sir Alex and you go through times and the teams. And when we get to Dennis, you know, one of the jokes is that we're trying to find a mistake. When did he make a mistake? And it's actually not completely impossible, because there is one, but that's it. It's just incredible, so dependable. And when you play behind a guy like that, it carries so much value, because as the goalkeeper the goalkeeper is a very reactive position. There's no proactive actions in there. You can't chase anything. You have to wait for stuff to happen. So a lot of goalkeeping is taking up positions as to where the play is. And it's so important that the players in front of you are consistent in what they do. So if the ball goes over there, you know that your defenders are going to do this. That means I can be here. With Dennis, it was 100%. You could
trust.
My God.
Yeah.
So that meant that when play was developing from the left-hand side, our left-hand defending side, my positions was always according to what Dennis was doing. And it was always consistent, and it's so valuable. I didn't have to guess. There's no doubt. I didn't have to think about it. Everything could be done instinctively, and that was, I mean, brilliant. And the thing is, and it doesn't happen for everyone. He's a right-footed left fullback. He also played on the right, not too much, because we had right-footed right backs. But when he swapped over, it would be the same. And you think about that. It is completely, I mean, it is a mirror. You have to everything the other way around. And that really impressed me, that he could do that. He was a fantastic. And then you have a fullback who also offers something going forward. His crosses on the left foot was fantastic. But and we see this everywhere now today, you have a left footed on right-hand side, and you got a right footed on left, because cutting in and, you know, threatening that way, it's dangerous. It can create chances, shooting opportunities. But back in the 90s, Dennis already did that. He scored so many great goals from that position.
I think you say in the book, and it's probably well known, that you weren't best buddies with Roy, but there was a respect there. In his book, he detailed a row that you had. Was your view in your book, I wanted to let Vegas be Vegas. I didn't want to get involved in revealing what happened in dressing rooms and that kind of thing. Was that your kind of approach?
I guess what's your reason behind writing a book? For me, this book is for me. This book was written for me to find out about myself. I mean, you work in this workplace. I'm absolutely convinced that you're not, you know, you don't have a pint with everybody in this place. There's certain players you go for a pint. Certain people people you don't. That it's the same with the football team. So for me, this book was not about, you know, settling scores or hanging anybody out to dry. Or this was about finding out, you know, who I am, and if it's an interesting story for other people to read, then it's very good. I really wanted some of it to be an inspiration as well. I found myself in a situation when I came back from the World Cup in 1998, where I made a very big decision. I made a decision to leave Man United, that was going to be my last season. And one of the things that I found out, having done this and having thought about it and analysed the situation that I found myself in there, is that I was probably stressed. I probably had a high level of stress, and I was not in a position to make those kind of decisions, and that's a very valuable thing for me to know, because I know deep in my heart I probably should never have left Man United. Why would I do that? I was dreaming of it. It's my club. I mean, that's just a silly thing to do. So why leave it? But I had my reasons. But I kind of thought myself into those reasons. I convinced myself that this is the reason, you know. And it was wrong in many ways. So one of my hopes for being so candid about it is that other players, because I know this is going to happen, other players will find themselves in a similar situation. If they read that and understand what I went through, and then try and do not to do what I did, then maybe open up a little bit more, you know, put some of your pride. Ask for a break. That happened eventually. I couldn't have had a break there, by the way, because it was such an important time for Manchester United. And that was part of the reason the whole thinking started. But more than anything, talk to people, speak to your manager. You know, I want to play every game, but sometimes you have to understand in this period that I am absolutely, completely mentally drained. Sometimes I might not be able to. So just bear this at the back of the mind. Maybe some of the games where you expect the goalkeeper not to be so much involved away from home, maybe not take me, you know. But I was too proud. I wanted to play every game. I was this big, strong Scandinavian guy who just wanted to play every game, and I didn't want to show any kind of weakness. And in looking back at all this, bear in mind I'm 57, and that it's 20 years ago. Looking back, I should have done that, but I made decisions for what I knew with the information I had back then. So that's part of my wishes with this book, that other players would read this and probably recognize those symptoms, and then maybe just step back a little bit and speak to people, talk to people about it, and then probably make better decisions.
He's made his own way. He's been very much his own man, and you've made sure that's the case with Casper. But that wisdom, that advice, that's the kind of thing you want to be giving to him.
Yeah, it's interesting when I say all this, it's been my intention that, you know, being honest about so many things, it will help some people. That's been my hope. And it was interesting when Casper read the book, he picked up on that straight away and said, this is good, because that's how I'm feeling now. He's coming back from the Euros. That's precisely how I'm feeling now. I don't know how I'm going to get through the next period. I don't. I have no idea. But now I understand that, you know, you can find yourself in these situations. And the good thing for Casper is that I've gone through a lot of things without really knowing what to do, not having the experience, and certainly not having people around me who would know or what to tell me or to guide me or advise me. But Kasper's got that. He's got, of course, he's got me, but he's got other people around him, and he's also playing in a time where it's okay to talk about stuff. You know, you've got sports psychiatrists that you can go on and talk to them in confidence, and you can get things off your chest. But of course, I've been in you know, I've been doing exactly the same as Kasper's doing now, so therefore he will ask me about stuff. That's the deal, by the way.
Yeah,
he's got to come to me.
Yeah, you don't go to him first. I read that in the book. Yeah. Other things I read, I was fascinated by the fact that you decided on all the penalties before the 92 semi-final against Holland, and you decided, you took control of the situation. Other things I was interested in is the stick you got at times from opposing fans, some of it pretty disgusting, which people can get to when they read the book. 1999, though, that a lot of Man United fans will always cherish that season. Your save against Bergkamp, the league and FA Cup wins, and then Barcelona, you beat Bayern. Just when you think back about that game, that incredible finish, what comes to mind initially?
Yeah, I find it really difficult to separate that period or make it into one game. It was an incredible. So what we just talked about, that was the beginning of that season, and then I have this break, and we end up. In the last 14 games, is played in what was it, 54, 57 days or something like that. It was a cup final every 3.8 day, cup final. Because when you look back, anything goes wrong in any of those games, we don't win the treble. So I kind of had that period in as one chunk of, yeah. The game in Barcelona, of course, is the last game. And, you know, we didn't play well. There were reasons for that. Roy didn't play. Scorsese didn't play. They were both suspended. A massive handicap for us because the team that we had excelled with those players. If you add that sort of starting 11, you add three more players to that, then you have, you know, you have just world-class players. But we kind of had Scorsese, Roy and Botti kind of rotating most of that season. So it was three players who are so fantastic in that engine room. And now we didn't have two of them. So it played a really big part in how we play that game. But what I really love about that game is that we just confirmed that we are that team that never gives in. We just carried on. We never panicked. We threw caution to the wind. I call it, in my book, I call it risk mode. We went into risk mode and we just, you know, slowly and slowly took more and more and more risk, and eventually it paid off. And I spoke to Alex Ferguson yesterday and I said, you know, the game, because I talk about the lineup in the you know, that he probably gets away with lining up, but I also see, you know, how complex it is and how difficult it must have been for him to put a team up because engine room's gone. And I said to him, I'm so happy that we played so bad. I'm so happy. Can you imagine if we played fantastically well and 3-0 up at halftime, and then that game was sort of won, and you know, you just slowly drive it home, and you know, in the last 20 minutes of the game, you know you won it, and you kind of get used to the idea, and the referee blows a whistle, and you're happy. And it wasn't like that. It wasn't like, we were 1-0 down, and we were into added time, and then we score this goal, you know, a minute into added on time. That takes us into extra time. It gives us that opportunity. And then within, you know, 90 seconds of that, we score a winner. I mean, you cannot win a game of football in a better way. And you cannot win in, you can never bring emotions out like that. Not only on the pitch, in the stadium and in people's minds. So this game lives, it has its completely own life. And it's a game that will never die. So anywhere I go, I would talk to people about that. And it's brilliant. Yeah.
Finally and briefly, Peter, and great to see you here in News Talk and Off the Ball. The man who scored the winner, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, are you confident by the end of the season United will be a good place with him?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I said this, when you're debating, talking headlines, you know, it's a all out, and I'm thinking, yeah, it's fair point. But then what? You know, all is working on a plan. It's, you can see that. I know in the last couple of games he's been criticised for not having a style of play, but we brought Ronaldo to the club, and of course you have to sort of, you have to find out how we maximise the team playing with Ronaldo. Ronaldo scores goals for fun. You know, he's already scored 5 goals in 4 games. I mean, this is what he does. Goals are the only thing that changes the outcome of a game. So we've got the goals now. Now we need to sort of find out what else can we do for the team. I think Ole is doing fantastically well. I see all the signs of the importance, the value of the values of a club, how the environment is supposed to be, how he's building on that idea of a winning environment. It's going in the right direction, and I'm happy with him.
The book is called One. Peter Schmeichel, thanks so much for coming in to Off the Ball here on News Talk, and I hope you'll enjoy the rest of your stay in the Emerald Isle.
It's brilliant here, isn't it?
It always is. And
so where do I go for the best pint of Guinness?
I don't want to get in trouble, but I would always say the McDade's is around the corner, and there's Mulligan's, and he's all these places in Dublin, and I'm not getting any kind of benefit out of this, but these are just the two places.
The thing is, every time I've been to Dublin, I tell people, oh, I was in Dublin, did you go for that pint? I said, yeah, I went there. Oh, no, you should have gone there, you know.
Well, that's it.
That can never go the right place.
We're spoiled for choice. We've got so many of them, but thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Off the Ball News Talk is back after this.
Football on Off the Ball
with Sky. Watch Premier League, Women's Super League, Scottish Premiership and much more live on Sky Sports.